Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, you're listening to Why Food. I'm Ethan Frisch.
I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we are so excited to be interviewing Chibuy today, who is the head chocolatier of K plus M Extra Virgin Chocolates. And as I speak, she is unpacking a pile of chocolate bars that I am really excited to taste and laying them out very carefully on a plate. So
with gloved hands.
Yeah, of course. So you guys get to listen to us eat chocolate, which is pretty much the best way to enjoy chocolate is by listening to other people eat it. Chi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me this afternoon.
And we always like to kick off the podcast with your aha moment. You've had a pretty varied career, starting with a degree in literature and an interest in poetry.
more chocolate.
You can't see this, but there's just like more chocolate coming out. And then after graduating from college, you went to work for the UN on an internet connectivity project that took you to Pakistan and Peru and Bolivia, did you say?
I didn't travel. We were headquartered in New York.
Okay.
But we actually were helping initiatives in Bolivia. I think the first initiative was in Pakistan. We were the first one to help them establish internet access, and it was all free, mostly for NGOs to actually gain access to developing information, so that way farmers and just anyone working in NGOs understanding developmental issues, really.
Yeah. And from there, you somehow wound up being an incredible chocolatier. Can you tell us the moment where you realized, after having done all these other things and juggled all of these other interests, how did you decide that food was where you should be pursuing a career?
You know, I think growing up, I always have the fondest memory of food. You know, it never occurred to me to choose it as a career path just because, well, it's kind of complicated for an Asian family. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of Asian chefs would identify with us.
I agree with that.
Yeah, it's not a career choice that, you know, anyone's family within Asia would, you know, advocate. And so there was a lot of resistance on my part. Not that my parents were pushing me against it. I never considered it. Let's put it that way. I was pursuing things that were more intellectually interesting for me, like literature, philosophy, that sort of thing. And I think after working at the United Nations, dealing with developmental issues, coming down with climate change and also our cultures, that was kind of eye-opening because studying, I think I went to a school where there were a lot of, it was the last bastion of Marxist economics. So we're just very, think of it as an idealized kid, you know, thinking about all these issues. And then coupling that with how food is being, you know, grown somewhere else and issues of access to resources and also poverty, that really opened up, you know, the questions of a wider perspective of geopolitical issues. After working in United Nations, that funding, well, the cycle changes every so often within UNDP. And so after working there for 10 years, my program actually was no longer funded because they changed their initiatives. And so I decided to take some time off anyway, because that was a point in my life where I was going to decide to have a family. And so being in New York, there's all this economic pressure to either work to pay for someone to take care of your kids. So I decided I'm just going to take care of my kids because this is the formative years of their life. And I have fond memory of growing up with my grandmother taking care of me as my mother was working all the time. And so I wanted to have that relationship with my kids. So anyway, so I took 10 years off. Raised my kid, but in that time, I cooked all the time, every day. I mean, my kids actually would wince at the idea of having leftovers for dinner, right? Because I have to
spoiled.
Cook. I know. And so during that period, it just awakened this love for food again, you know, because I have to cook every day and I loved it. And so that engendered the love of food again. And so I decided, why don't I go back to school for culinary school, right? And I thought, well, if I was going to go back to school, I know how to cook. And I have a really good sense of smell and taste, so I can kind of deconstruct a savory dish, but I don't know how to do baking. And so I decided, if I'm going to go back to school for something I don't know, why don't we choose, you know, a subject that I don't know at all? So I decided to do pastry because it was a challenge. And because I went to school in pastry, I was exposed to chocolate. And that rekindled memories again in my childhood when I was growing up. All those study sessions during undergraduate, graduate, eating chocolate, mostly, I'm sorry, but it's Hershey in those days. Hershey with almonds, but I would always eat it with a tea pairing because I couldn't eat that stuff straight up.
And you, when you were growing up, your family had also had an interesting history with food. Can you kind of tell us about that and your mom's cooking and...
You know what? We grew up, I mean, in Vietnam, I came from a well-to-do family. And so when we, after the war, we immigrated to the U.S. and we lost everything. So my mother, because she has a higher status in Vietnam, she never learned how to cook. We always had cleaners and so forth. And we had an excellent cook growing up, right? So when we came to the U.S., well, we lost everything. So she had to cook for the family, and she didn't know how. And so it took her a series of 2 years, actually, to learn how to cook for us because we were so critical of her cooking. If she didn't get it right, she had to do something again because there would be 6 kids, and there's my father, and he wouldn't support her. He would support us because he couldn't eat it, and he couldn't eat
it.
I know. So after 2 years of struggling, she actually became an excellent cook.
And then went on to work in food. Right?
Yeah, and then exactly. And then she ended up actually, she and my dad ended up running a truck. I mean, it was a Greek food truck.
And how did that happen?
I don't know. I mean, I think my mother just saw, like, you know, she was cleaning at that point and, you know, she couldn't speak English. And so that wasn't an option to go do beyond just cleaning. And so she saw an opportunity of, you know, there's this, you know, being an entrepreneur, you know, pretty much establishing your hours, running your own business. And she has always been that way. But in this case, it's a food truck. And she thought, you know, I'll learn how to do that. And so she did. She and my dad end up, you know, buying a Greek food truck from a Greek individual. And they learned how to make, just pretty much learn how to do everything. The only thing that was Greek in that food truck was the Greek salad. Everything else was American, like egg salad, what is it, tuna salad, BLT, cheesesteak, because, you know, this happened to be in Philadelphia, and the truck would be, like, right there, parking the street, right outside University of Pennsylvania.
And do you eat any of these foods today? Do you make any of these things now?
No, I don't.
What kind of food do you like to cook now, or what kind of food did you like to cook for your kids when they were growing up?
You know, I cook some Vietnamese, but a lot of Vietnamese food, you know, because there's a lot of saute stuff. So it's a lot of vegetables and greens. And I love rice. I can't live without eating rice at least once a week. If I don't, I feel somehow I'm missing out on something. And my children actually don't feel the same way. They love bread. And I love bread, too. I mean, I can really enjoy bread. But after a week, you know, I'm for some reason, I need that. Exactly. So I forced them. I forced my, you know, my rice-centric, you know, eating habits onto my kids.
And how did you learn to cook the Vietnamese dishes that you like to make now?
Okay, so as we were growing up, my mother had to learn how to cook Vietnamese because that was the only thing we knew. And so she learned through friends and other friends, and she'll test out the recipes. And I think, I would like to think that she perfected it on us. You know, and she actually, she became an excellent cook, actually. And she ended up discover another part of herself that she never had before, which is she enjoyed cooking. She would, you know, constantly changing, mix it up constantly. It's the same format, meaning the same recipe. So she'll make pho during the weekend, always, right? But she'll change it every so often, you know. She'll introduce this, introduce that. She always tweaking. She wasn't always happy, whatever. She constantly, continually tweak things. Same thing with Bung Ba Hue, which is, we're from Hue, which is the center of Vietnam. And there is this noodle soup that she'll make, and she'll always tweaking it. But there's other dishes, you know, that is laborious, that takes really time. Something like Ban Bok Lok, which is a central piece as well. It's a ravioli, really. But you have to wrap it in banana leaves, so it takes a long time to make these things. And I really, she enjoyed doing it. And I learned, actually, that, you know, just helping her cooking the kitchen, the joy of cooking.
And, I mean, she had pretty crazy hours. You were telling us earlier at lunch of packing up this food truck, getting home at midnight, Having to wake up the next morning. What were some of the things you just learned from, you know, seeing her be an entrepreneur and building a business?
I mean, I think my mother was a tour de force. She was really hardworking. I think for 20 years that she had this food truck, she only functioned about 4.5 hours sleep. You know,
that's crazy.
It was very long hours, but it's really not that the food truck was open for 12 hours. It's just that, you know, when they finish, which is about 7 o'clock at the end of the day, they would drive home and she'll unpack everything, clean it, prep for the next morning, and then it takes until midnight when she'll finish, because it's really her and my dad. That's mm-hmm. it, right? And so this is when I was younger, so I was just mostly focused on studying and just making dinner. I would help out by making dinner. Mm-hmm. And then she'll wake up at 4:30 in the morning to prep for the truck, and then they'll open up around 7 o'clock in the morning. So it's I kind of lied. They held 12-hour days, but you know, but you know, she was a really hardworking individual. I mean, to this day, I credit if I have any perseverance, is because of my mom. It was, you know, show by examples.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So were your family surprised when you told them you were going back into food after they knew that you already saw how hard it was, and then you had decided to kind of pursue more of a art and international development career? So then, like, what did they say when you said, hey, I'm in pastry school?
Yeah, I don't think at this point my mother has passed on, and so it's just mostly my dad and my siblings. But, you know, I come from actually a really oddball family anyway. One of my brother is an artist, so that was a lost cause in an Asian community, right?
Yeah.
and so I became this, like, another one who just doesn't know what she wants to do in life or not building a career. And so when I chose culinary school, they're scratching their heads. But, you know, I think in some ways my family is actually open. As long as you do what you love, it really doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. And how did you were telling us over lunch how you were thinking about, you went to graduate school, yep. You were writing, but you were thinking, maybe this isn't what I want to do. Like, how did you figure that out?
Well, you know, I think what it is I'm really critical, self-critical. So if I'm struggling at something and I know I'm not good at it, and I can tell, you know, I'm not delusional. Like, I can see the writings on the wall pretty early on. And that makes me assess, you know, my ability constantly. You know, am I good enough? What am I doing? And I really don't like doing things I'm not good at, because life is short. and also, I don't enjoy doing something I'm not good at.
That's such an interesting sentiment from a career changer, and especially somebody who's made the dramatic shifts that you've made. I mean, going into culinary school, you couldn't have known that you, especially since you chose pastry, which was not your strength in the kitchen, you couldn't have known that you were going to be good at it, or starting to work with chocolate. You didn't know beforehand that you were going to be good working with chocolate. So how have you made those decisions? How have you taken those pretty dramatic steps, not knowing that you were going to be good at something, but still deciding to pursue it pretty wholeheartedly?
Actually, that's a good question. I think, yeah, I was pretty much opening myself to all possibilities.
Yeah.
When I was in culinary school, I did everything. I mean, I was, you know, going here at the James Beard Foundation to help out, you know, the chefs when they're visiting. And I wasn't doing pastry. I was doing whatever they asked me.
Yeah.
And, you know, one point, one of the chefs asked me to prepare family meal. And there wasn't any ingredients other than what was there. that was fun because it was challenging. You get the scraps and you just put it together and make something. And it was really well received, you know?
What did you make?
What was it? I think that dinner was steak. And so the scrap that they gave me was mostly just connective tissues. And so I was just fabricating, getting whatever was left between the connective tissue, whatever's meat is left, I took it out. And I saute it, and they happened to make a stock. It was mostly a beef bouillon that they would boil down to make a sauce, and they had plenty of it left. So I decided to add more water and more vegetable in it to make it a soup instead. And instead of putting because the meat was actually a tenderloin, which was very little fat, I didn't want to cook it into the soup, so I just saute it just ever so slightly, and I would put the soup on top. Anyway, and then they had scrap because one of them were doing, I think, beef Wellington, which requires puff pastry. And so there were a bunch of scraps. I was like, what the heck? I'll use this to make, you know, some kind of like decor. And I baked it, you know, first sprinkle some spice, aromatics, and baked it into, you know, kind of like a stick of sort and put that with the soup. Anyway, so I whatever they had, I just combined it. And the actually, amazingly, the staff there really, you know, they thought it was well received, so that was kind of nice. And I think that was what pushes me. You're like, oh, I guess I'm not that bad. I can put something together, you know. That gave a little bit of a boost of confidence. And as I go through the culinary school, I discovered that I'm pretty good with my hand, craft wise, you know. So you know, I can do flowers, whatever. I guess I'm a little crafty without realizing. And so as I'm learning the program, I'm actually pretty good with my hands. And that really helps, especially in pastry, especially with cakes, actually. When you do a lot of flours, you know, gum paste flours and things like that. And then I discovered chocolate. And then I was like, boom, that was first love. Because it was so precise chocolate. And I'm pretty kind of anal as a person. I'm very precise. And so chocolate just fits my personality really well. As a medium, it's you have to be precise. And then as a medium, it's really flexible. You could do so many things with it. And also the fact is I love eating chocolate, you know?
What was when you first like had chocolate, or at least in the context of pastry or in culinary school, and you knew it was the thing that you wanted to do? Like, can you describe that experience in more detail?
Well, you know, we had to do, so there's a session within culinary school in pastry. So you do pastries, and then at some point you do a chocolate module, right? And we each have to do a showpiece. And that was so much fun because you have to you have to make something that's decorative. And so there's another level that comes in besides just making bonbons. So on top of the showpiece, you have to make bonbons that have to taste a certain way. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it tickles both types of, you know, part of your brain. One is, creating something that tastes fantastic, but also the visual part.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really, really fun.
What was your showpiece?
What was it? Oh my gosh. I was trying to make a tree trunk, and they didn't teach us how to make pool sugar, because in those days, I mean, in pastry, you can actually do pool sugar and make actually decorative flowers or whatever with sugar. And so I decided to keep pooling. I made this like petals out of it. Just YouTubing things. And then, you know, and I made the glass, you know, pretty much the idea of a cherry growing next to a pond, and I made a bunch of little birds with eggs. Anyway, so that was like awesome. A little scene.
That sounds awesome.
The thing that I think is interesting about working with chocolate, especially the difference between working with chocolate as a pastry chef and now a lot of what you're doing is working with chocolate sort of at origin, or thinking more about where it comes from and the fermentation processes, is that you talk now about chocolate being a very precise ingredient and something that requires a lot of attention to detail. But most pastry chefs are missing the first, 90% of the chocolate's life, from the farm to the harvest to the fermentation to all of those processes, the grinding even.
Yep.
So how have you broadened that precision that you have as a pastry chef to this much bigger, much more complicated, much, much harder to control and more unpredictable process going back to origin with the chocolate?
That's a good question. I think the reason why this path is like, because it's a lot of work, right? Being a pastry chef is one thing. That's all engrossing. And being a chocolatier, which is a subset of that, right? Focusing only on chocolate and coming up with flavor profile combination within the context of chocolate is also engrossing. So and then to move beyond that to like, okay, so here's the ingredient, chocolate, how is it made and so forth. That also is another process that requires an all engrossing, you know, time-consuming effort. So that's why you have a lot of compartmentalization and career decisions, because it's very difficult to do all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you really can't. I mean, to be, it's a lot of work. It's like, you know, it's very, I think seldom do you find a bread maker who grinds their own, you know,
bread.
Flour. Or roses.
Yeah, exactly. So there are a few. There are a few. I'm not saying there aren't, but it's truly a very difficult task undertaking. It's very challenging, and so very few people do it. And if they do, then they focus on, you know, expressing the flavor profile that comes out of their effort. Because if you're going to take this much effort and energy to focus on, you know, growing a fantastic wheat, you don't want to alter it so much. You want to highlight it, mm-hmm. right?
How did you decide that the supply chain, you wanted to focus on the supply chain, you wanted to focus on more of the raw material?
I think I'm a curious person at heart. So when I start doing chocolate and making bonbons, and then I want to ask, well, how is the chocolate being made,
mm-hmm.
right? And then how that process come about? So there's always these questions of how and where, at which point did it lead to here? So I keep going back and going back, and that keeps pushing the whole entire process back to how chocolate is being made, how the beans are being fermented, and how that affects in terms of the farmers. And then now it goes back to also my, you know, previous life at working in United Nations is now the geopolitical, you know, situation comes in, right? And having that background really informs or at least open up the perspective much more. So it's not just taking an ingredient here and not questioning and just transforming it. It's also, how did it get here,
mm-hmm.
right? What condition makes these possible, right? So in order to get a great ingredient, some effort has to go into it to get it there, right? And, you know, cocoa beans, it's really under, you know, it's one of those ingredients as well as coffee and tea, but coffee actually is much further down the road than we are.
Further down the road in
meaning development wise, recognition wise, in terms of the pricing and the effort that goes into it, the labor cost, because coffee in some ways, you have a fantastic coffee, you roast it and there you go, right? And okay, the process of brewing is important, but that's it. Chocolate is actually much more complex. There's much more process steps in between. So you have the cocoa that's being grown, right? And it has to be fermented. And not everyone can ferment it properly. And the fermentation is very important to actually get those precursor flavors for wonderful chocolate. And so that step is, you know, sometimes ignored or is not done properly. And, after fermentation, there's drying process. You rush it too much. There's molding. There's all the other stuff. And then once you get that to the factory, then the roasting process is what expresses the precursor flavor profile that is developed in the fermentation can't be expressed without roasting. That's why if you notice, eating raw chocolate is very, very different tasting than chocolate has been roasted,
mm-hmm.
right? So given that said, so there's all these steps and it's very, very complicated and a lot of effort and a lot of things can go wrong.
What are some of the geopolitical things surrounding the chocolate trade that you've now had to encounter or think about as you've been sourcing the beans?
Well, I don't have to encounter because we're sourcing mostly from Central America and South America. And those beans are recognized. I mean, we're paying. It's not even like fair prices. It's way beyond that. So the workers, I mean, the farmers and the suppliers know that the beans are, you know, in demand. So mm-hmm. the pricings are very competitive. I mean, exceedingly so. So we're competing. At this point, we're like other coffee makers who actually go in having to like pretty much accept the pricing of whatever has been set for us. We don't negotiate. They just give us the pricing and we say, yes, you know, pretty
and that's
much
a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we like your beans and yeah, even though it's X amount and really some of it is actually four times more than the pricing, commodity pricing, we'll say yes, because it's worth it, right? Because the effort that they put in and also is so special. Now, this is a different model. And so that's why our chocolate, and I think the craft movement is really doing a good job in terms of, you know, bringing the awareness to consumer that, you know, there's a lot of effort and energy and resource that goes into producing these things. So the suppliers, meaning the farmers, need to be compensated accordingly. Because really, for a long time, we're talking about 150 years, colonization, I mean, cocoa has been subsidized by colonization, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the beans were exported to Africa, and that was labor-free because slavery and colonization didn't pay for your the colonizer did not pay for the laborers, you know? And that goes with coffee as well as tea. Right, mm-hmm. The tea gardens in India, they weren't subsidized. None of those labor was subsidized. And so the pricing has really been depressed for that long, 150 years. Remember, cocoa has been the most expensive ingredient in ancient time. Right? It wasn't available for everyone. Colonization made it possible for the general population to actually gain access to it, which is well and good. But at the same time, the pricing has been depressed for so long, like, because there's only a few companies making it, Hershey, Mars, and so forth. And these are like, you know, a lot of sugar in it. But not only that, they were the one who actually made it. They're the market. So they set the pricing.
Oh.
Right?
So do you see at any point in the future, as the craft movement starts to gain more steam, that the commodity pricing will change at all, or cocoa will be able to come out from under that?
I think there could be dual tool. So you still have commodity pricing in coffee, but you also have specialty coffee, right? Mm-hmm. So the craft movement actually is really great in that way. It's creating, shall we say, something similar to the specialty coffee in that way. There's a demand for cocoa that is not within the commodity pricing, right? Yeah. It's no longer within that model anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. And I think a lot of consumers now are being a little more susceptible, open to the idea that you have to pay more for better ingredients and better food.
Yep. Yeah.
Because it doesn't come cheap. Someone has to make that, you know? And if something requires so much effort and resources to make it, well, everyone has to make a living up to that point, right? From the grow all the way to transformation to the product itself.
It's so interesting that you talk about chocolate as that process is still taking place, or even at sort of an early phase in that process. In dealing with spices, I feel like I'm so far behind. The market is so far behind even cacao. I use cacao as the example of a market where people do have an appreciation for higher quality, for the labor that goes into that, for the terroir of different origins. Where in spices, people just have no idea. People don't even think about spices as coming from plants. So
they actually grow out
exactly. So
it's so sad, right? Because once upon a time, the East Indian Company was started because spice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
was like the most expensive. In fact, you can trade I don't know what for spices, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's sad that it gets to the point where it became this cheap thing that people just could throw away. I mean, someone has to make those.
Yeah, someone has to grow them. Yeah, I think we're in this really amazing time for food, right? Yeah. That people are starting to think more about where ingredients come from, about the people who are involved in their supply chains, about exactly what you're talking about, the legacy of colonialism that has subsidized so much of the way that we eat and the way that we think about food.
And how much we are willing to pay for it.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, I think a lot of restaurants are kind of caught in that trap too, where it's you want to do all these things like pay your workers more. You want to be able to give them health care. But then if you increase your prices by 20-25%, all of a sudden you don't have the demand because it's a complicated cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should take a quick break. We're a little behind. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in 2 minutes with Chiboy, who's the head chocolatier of K+M Extra Virgin Chocolates.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market, whatever makes you whole.
Nightmares of once less.
we're back.
Welcome back. Today we're here with Chi Bui, the head chocolatier of K plus M Extra Virgin Chocolate. And we have a lot of beautiful chocolate in front of us. So I'll let Chi tell us a little bit about the backstory of the chocolate, and then we're going to do some on-air tasting.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a long story. I mean, this project started 6 years ago. Thomas and Armando have been friends for 12 years. In fact, they've been friends ever since Thomas was introduced.
That's Thomas
to,
Keller and
yes.
Armando...
Mani.
Mani. Okay. So Armando Mani is the olive oil maker from Tuscany. So they became friends after Thomas actually tasted Armando's olive oil, and he was just... thought it was the best olive oil there is, so he decided to use it throughout all the restaurants per se, French Laundry, Bouchon, and so forth. And they've been friends since. I mean, Armando has a great personality, and Thomas, you know, he's very generous. They're great. They're really. I mean, I'm fortunate actually to be working for these two guys. I am very appreciative of them. Actually, great personalities. And so 6 years ago, both of them. Actually, they happen to love chocolate as well. And so 6 years ago, they were eating chocolate, and Armando was saying to Thomas, look, Thomas, I've been working with the University of Florence for the last 15 years to make my olive oil in terms of high antioxidants and so forth. And do you know the cocoa beans actually have very high antioxidant? It's a superfood like tea, olive oil, blueberries. But in the process of making chocolate, you lose about 60 to 80% of the antioxidant. Right. So why don't we work with the University of Florence, try to understand the process, at which point you lose how much, and see if you can come away to make a chocolate that is high in antioxidant by reducing the loss of what's naturally in it. And at the end, instead of adding cocoa butter, which is the tradition in Europe to always add extra cocoa butter for the mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, you know, extra cocoa butter is added so that it's more, you know, it doesn't gum up in your palate when you add the extra cocoa butter. It's just like has an improved, clean mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. And so instead of doing that, why don't we add my extra virgin olive oil? You know, it's high in antioxidant, but it's a different type of antioxidant. It's actually polyphenol, which is not the same thing as the antioxidant in the cocoa bean. The cocoa bean is high in flavanol. So between these two, you create a bioavailable because mm-hmm. antioxidant is actually one type of anything is not really... you know, that useful for the body. Sometimes the body requires a bunch of, you know, things in combination for it to actually be able to use. And so why don't we do that? And they did. And so they worked with the University of Florence for 3 years, actually, to do a series of studies to understand at what point in the process how much is being lost. And after those 3 years, I came into the scene. They needed someone, a chocolate maker, to take all that studies with, you know, input from the University of Florence and try to come up interfacing methodology-wise and process it into chocolate form. And so, you know, 3 years ago, I came onto the project. We opened the factory, I would say a year and a half, you know, actually 2 years ago. And then we introduced a chocolate a year and a half ago.
And how did you feel when they approached you about this project?
I was, like, blown over because at this point I was making chocolate anyway. And the idea of working with the University of Florence, understanding the antioxidant, how, processing, fermentation, all of that affects the levels of the antioxidant was fascinating. I mean, you know, I used to be a graduate student, so I do a lot of research. And so reading scientific reviews and things like that was really fascinating. So this is, like, on the intellectual level, it was like, wow, this is great. I get to explore another portion of chocolate I never experienced before, and this is great. And on top of, you know, making chocolate, being able to, like, source it directly. So there's all these combination of things that just played into what I was, you know, wanting to do, really. And so I was like, yes, of course, sign me up.
Okay, so let's taste some chocolate. You've been torturing us with this beautiful plate of chocolate out on the table.
So just so you know, this chocolate actually, you know, is a corroboration. And when actually these are made in a way that try to preserve the antioxidant in the cocoa beans. And we age our chocolate, so the aromatics are balanced. And then towards the end is when we add the olive oil, because olive oil is very delicate. So mm-hmm. there's this fine line between two type of ingredients we have to pretty much adhere to. And so these chocolates are processed in a way that's very light, so you don't lose all the antioxidant, and then on top of it, we add the olive oil, which gives another boost of the antioxidant. So and the mouthfeel is going to be very, very different.
And is the antioxidant, is the emphasis on antioxidants, is that for the health benefits or something to do with flavor? Or
it
why
is.
Do you, why
oh,
do
it's
that?
Two things. Yeah. The antioxidant actually is a health benefit, but the interesting thing is it also is what gives the flavor profile, too. So more of it you lose more of the flavor. It's the same thing in olive oil, right? Mm. It when you have extra virgin olive oil, it's very vibrant and it's supposed to burn.
Oh.
When it doesn't burn, that means it's no longer extra virgin, meaning it's pretty much dead. Right?
Yeah, it's like peppery in the back.
Yeah, exactly. And you want to cough, right? Mm-hmm. So the antioxidant, once it's lost, you lose a lot of aromatics. So really, yes, it does affect it as well. So not only is the health, but also the flavor. So really this project is really seeking the middle ground between deliciousness and luxuriousness and health.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you're giving us these chocolates to taste, can you explain what the best way is to taste chocolate to really get the best sense of it?
Well, I would suggest going from dark to milk because the milk powder has fat and that coats your palate. So I suggest going dark to milk.
Okay.
And we're going to go from the lightest bean to the darkest bean. And we have four single origin. They're all the same, 75%. Because I like the idea. You know, the idea is one point of reference, four mm-hmm. single origin. I would go with the Madagascar.
Okay. And what do you mean by darkest, lightest bean to darkest bean?
Just the flavor profile. It's like if you eat the Madagascar, it's a very light. I would chew this one.
Well, I'm going to take one of each, and then I'm going to pass the plate to Jenny.
Okay. Yes. Go
right?
ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how did you find the suppliers for these beans?
Well, you know, being working with Thomas, you know, he's well known in the industry to be, you know, very fastidious about his ingredients. And being so, he understood that, you know, in order to make anything fantastic tasting, you have to work with great ingredients, right? So, I mean, his reputation is known for that. And so when we start working with our partners to source, they understood, you know, the mission. They're not in it economically. They're here to actually support the vision because mm-hmm. I think chocolate can be fantastic as an ingredient. But it has to be used by the right people. Otherwise, you kind of lose, you know. If you give someone fantastic beans but don't know how to use it, then you kind of lost the specialness of it. And so they understood that, and they really respect and they really want to encourage that as well. So that's how we managed to actually get fantastic beans is because we have really, in you know, like people who work in the industry for a very long time, very established, you know, relationships.
And you said when we were eating lunch that they bring you a lot of samples, you try a lot of things, and then you don't take all of them.
No.
So what's the percentage of, like, things, you know, that you actually accept?
I reject a lot. So the bean comes in, I evaluate them. You know, I reject a lot. I mean, because what I look for is we look for transparency, you know, sustainability, right? But we also want the direct trade. So we want a relationship eventually to establish where we have some input on the ingredients. And then also the most important part is because there's more than one, is the aromatic complexity. Because I'm not looking for one type of flavor profile. I want, because when we're building, let's say four single origin, five or six, each one has to be somewhat different, right? So we're thinking of a bigger, you know, oeuvre, shall we say, selection. And so, and when I'm looking for one, I want something really expressive, a lot of flavor, a lot of depth, a lot of complexity.
So what are the countries that you source from? You said today we have Madagascar, and what are the other three?
Then the next one is Peru.
Okay, I'm eating the Madagascar now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the next, so Peru, and the third one is Ecuador, and the last one is Nicaragua. And they're very, I mean, they're all drastically different.
How would you characterize the differences between some of these?
Well, the Madagascar is a lighter bean, and the fermentation.
Very fruity.
Yeah, exactly, because it's a higher acidity. So it's very bright, you know, crisp and fruity, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's more like I would, and if I have to give an analogy to wine, it would be like a champagne, you know?
Sure.
A little bit of that, right? And the next one, Peru. Peru is really a lot of complexity. There's a lot of nuance going on with Peru. And there's also a little bit of a tannin, too.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was to compare the Peru to a wine, I would say it would be closer to a Burgundy, like a Pinot Noir with a nice aged one with a little bit of tannin towards the end. Not all tannins are bad, actually. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually nice to have a little bit of a tannin.
The mouthfeel is very different,
yes.
Indeed. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you're right, because most dark chocolate is very brittle and dry on your palate, and these chocolate are not. It's 75% across the board, but they're not. They're very velvety and smooth, and the reason why is it's actually the high polyphenic content in the olive oil that's cleaning your palate. It works like a cleaner. It cleans your palate and allows you to actually detect all the flavors and nuance in the beans, but also it changes the mouthfeel too.
And when you're tasting chocolate, what's the best way? Should we chew on it, or what's the best way to really bring out the flavors in your mouth?
Okay, that's a good question. I suggest putting a small piece in your mouth, chew it 3 times, and just let it melt.
3 times, exactly. Front of your mouth or back?
I'm kidding. It's actually the back. It's fine. You know, because the back is the most, probably the hardest part anyway, versus the front. But yeah, just let it melt, and you can detect the flavor profile and also the mouthfeel.
I'm eating the Peru one now, and it has a taste that, it's so familiar. It's like, I don't know what it is. It's like something from my childhood, and I can't quite place it. But you know how, I don't know if this is actually in the bean or like if this is a tasting note that people would give, but you know how memory is so correlated. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there. So I'm curious, when you and Thomas Armando are eating chocolate together, what is everyone saying? How are you guys evaluating? What are the words that are being used?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think they pretty much defer to me on this one. But that doesn't mean they're going to say, yeah, you decide. Of course, they're going to have to decide whether this is yeah, good or no. But ultimately, It's actually my call to decide the sourcing of the beans. Mm-hmm. And then once it passed my evaluation, it gets sent to the University of Florence. They do a bunch of tests for antioxidant potentiality and volatile potentiality. And volatile is exactly where the flavor automatic is coming through. Mm-hmm. And if you pass that evaluation, then we actually proceed to direct trade. So that's really the process.
Is there different olive oils in each one, or they're all the same?
Same amount. So the only difference you're going to detect is the different types of bean.
Yeah, the Peruvian one really reminds me. I get the tannins that you're talking about. It reminds me of tea a little bit. There's like a little bit of a black tea or a dark oolong or something. Mm-hmm. What are we eating now? What's the third one?
The third one is Ecuador.
Okay.
And Ecuador is a different type of bean. It's actually coming from... It's indigenous to the area. It's called Nación, which is indigenous to Ecuador. And in the old days, it's called Riba. And it's like, I think the third preferred beans. First was, Mexico was like the highest status bean. And then the second one is Venezuela. And then the third is Ecuador. But, you know, things are changing now all the time because there's always coming different origins and people are doing fermentation properly. And so that can really affect a lot of in terms of flavor profile.
This one has sort of a root vegetable sweetness. Sort of reminds me of beets or carrots or...
I can see
like
that.
Like a radish sweetness, maybe? Maybe I'm... this sounds ridiculous.
No. It actually is... It tastes sweeter, even though they're all 75%, meaning there's about, the balance is sugar. So... But the reason why it tastes sweeter is because the bean actually has very low acidity and very low astringency. And so it tastes sweeter. But not only that, notice that on your palate, it's actually it's velvetier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because this bean actually is less fat, has less fat to it than the others. Huh. And so it lingers on your palate much longer because of that.
If I closed my eyes and ate this, I would think I was eating milk chocolate. Mm. It's very soft. Yeah. Good milk chocolate. Yeah.
And what does the chocolate fruit look like on the tree, and how does it taste when you eat it fresh?
So, cocoa beans coming from a pot, and a pot can be really big too. It's still pretty big or small. The smallest one would be still... substantial. It holds about 35 beans on the inside.
Like the size and shape of a papaya, sort of,
yeah,
or something
exactly.
like that, right?
Yeah, a small papaya to a very large papaya. and the flesh on the inside is a white pulp that goes around the beans, and it's delicious, actually. And within the same farm, and I've been to many, you can taste from one tree to the next because there's changes, in terms of genetics. From one tree to the next, you can taste, one fruit to the next. They taste slightly different. Like if on one tree it would taste a little bit like mango and slightly sour, the other one could be a little more lychee. So it actually ranges, but there's always a little bit sweet and sourness to it. Mm-hmm. And it could be mango-ish to planty to actually lychee. There's one that I remember eating one in Peru that tastes exactly like lychee. It was delicious.
That's crazy.
And why don't people eat the fruit more? Why isn't that a...
Good question. Yeah, the reason why they don't is because it's needed to actually ferment.
The sugar
it's,
from the fruit.
It's a sugar. It's, yeah, exactly. That's what helps the fermentation process. It's the sugar that the yeast breaks down as food. And then after the yeast die out, bacteria, lactobacteria takes over, and that's another step of fermentation process. Yeah.
Right. We're going to pivot in the last couple of minutes to our rapid fire kind of silly personal question segment.
Oh, dear.
So where should
so
we start?
Scary.
You kick it off. You kick it off.
If you could master a skill, any skill overnight, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good one. Perfumery.
Why, what is it about perfumery?
Oh, because intellectually it's such a complex endeavor, you know? It's like trying to come up with a complex composition or writing a huge long novel with a lot of thought, planning, and the execution. So for me, I like the idea of working on something that requires a lot of thought and planning and building. I like complex structures and complex compositions. For me, that is what highlights us as a species, because we build things, you know, and the more things we build and we think about things, it become much more complex, and we grew, you know, we actually as a species grew out of that, you know?
And a follow-up question, I guess. We ask that question a lot to a lot of our guests, but with you, I almost get the sense that you're not interested in mastering a skill overnight, that it's something about the process that really gets you excited. Is that, would you say that that's an accurate?
No, that's true. Assessment? I mean, it's true. I like also things that takes time to build, you know, because I like all good things, it does take time and there's no shortcuts.
Yep. What is your preferred type of chocolate?
I prefer black dark chocolate, something that is complex, you know. I don't eat a lot of chocolate. I taste. it's unfortunately a side effect of my profession. Right. It's like coffee taster, right?
Yeah.
Traders don't really drink a lot of coffee because you taste all the time, and so it's the same thing with me. I don't eat it to enjoy anymore. It becomes like always. Thinking what exactly is in it and so forth, and you know, so it becomes like, you know, but that doesn't mean I don't enjoy it. It's just it transformed.
And how about your kids? Are they, how do they feel about chocolate?
My kids actually love chocolate.
Do they like dark chocolate or
do they like
chocolate?
Your chocolate?
You know, they're very critical, actually.
I'm not surprised.
You know, they're really hot.
given what you've told us about your childhood, I'm not surprised that your kids are also critical.
Yeah. Actually, but I kind of like that they're critical, because it actually makes me try harder.
And maybe your kids could be some of the only children in America who get to go say something to Thomas Kell and be like, I don't like this, or I do like this. That's a very enviable position.
I just ate a bite of the Madagascar milk chocolate. I don't think I've ever tasted chocolate that was so... It tastes like butterscotch or caramel. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That one is...
That's the Madagascar milk chocolate.
Oh, no, that's not milk. No, yeah, not, no, that is milk, but actually not Madagascar. It's Ecuador. So we had Ecuador and Nicaragua.
In milk chocolate.
In dark milk. And then milk is Nicaragua and Ecuador. So you can do because at the moment, you could do a horizontal tasting, which is four beans under 75%. And then you could do two verticals, meaning you can take Ecuador and Nicaragua and go vertically, meaning going from dark to dark milk and milk.
I'm just going to do a horizontal and diagonal tasting. Yeah. I'm just going to eat everything all over the place.
What do you recommend? You were talking about chocolate and tea earlier. Yeah. A good tea pairing for chocolate.
Mm. Oh, you know what? Oolong is such a complex and wide, you know, tea varietal, going from lightly oxidized to really strongly oxidized. I think oolong can be really fun. Mm-hmm. And pu'er too, you know, but you have to like drink it. I can't tell you on the top of my head because it's not fresh in my memory. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some pu'er can really go really well with some of this, you know. But really, I think on the whole, oolong, because it has such a wide range, you can start playing around with it.
That's awesome.
And what do you use it as a palate cleanser when you're tasting tons of chocolate?
You know what I do? I don't do oolong. I do green tea.
As a palate cleanser?
Yeah. So I have two things. I have water and I have tea. Tea what happens is you can use water as a palate cleanser, but it's too slow.
Mm-hmm.
So since I have to evaluate so much and I need to get it out of my palate as much as possible, I use the tea that melts everything off of my palate, right? And I drink water to clean the tea from my palate. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I go through so many and I need to just get it out of my palate as soon as possible so I can evaluate the next one, that's what I do.
How do you like to eat your eggs? Removing ourselves from chocolate
going
for a second.
Back to the
easy over.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what did you eat for lunch as a kid growing up?
Oh, for lunch? Oh my gosh. I think I must eat sandwiches all my life.
What kind of sandwiches?
Just mostly cheese sandwiches.
Cheese.
From the Greek food truck?
Feta cheese sandwiches?
No, it's actually cheddar cheese, grilled. Grilled cheese sandwich with cheddar cheese, not American cheese, processed cheese.
Do you make grilled cheese sandwiches for your kids, or did you when they were younger?
You know what? The funny thing is, no, they just don't like dairy.
Huh?
Yeah, they're kind of like lactose intolerant, which is unfortunate because I love cheese. I adore cheese. So my husband and I just like love cheese, and my children just don't because they're lactose intolerant. So I kind of feel for them.
Yeah.
But they can still have dark chocolate, so.
That's true.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. It was such a treat to have all this chocolate. We'll continue eating as we go off air. But can you tell our listeners one more time where to find you as well as where to find K plus M?
Okay. So we're actually the factory's in Napa. So if you're ever in Napa, just look us up and contact us and we'll just give you a tour in terms of finding the chocolate. I mean, you know, it's I think if you're interested in what the process is actually, it's, you know, we're willing to have people come in and look through the process. And in terms of the chocolate bar itself, in New York, we're actually in the Meadow, if you want to get it. Mm. Williams-Sonoma carries it. And hopefully Dean and DeLuca soon.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
And where do we find you online as well?
Yes, and you can find us online on our website or the Finesse the Store, which is our you know, stores that Thomas curate.
That's great. And Jenny, where do people find you and your work?
Oh, yes. Well, you can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at YFoodPodcast. And if you have any comments, questions, thoughts on this episode today, as well as questions for Chi, please email us YFood@heritageradionetwork.org.
What about your personal?
Oh, my
your
personal. Professional, okay. I'm over at Chef Jenny Dorsey. What about you, Ethan?
And I'm at Burlap and Barrel on Facebook and Instagram. And this is Why Food. Chi, thank you so much for joining us and bringing all this amazing chocolate and sharing your incredible wealth of knowledge about these very complicated processes.
Thank you for having me. It's been a joy. I really love talking about chocolate. So
thank you.
And thanks to Blind by the Red Crickets for our theme song and Vitor Hirsch, our amazing engineer. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization, driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Well, that's history of mine.